A quick reminder before we get going, this is the second part of a longer discussion. The first half came out in the last episode 2 weeks ago. You may want to go back and listen to that if you haven't. It was Emma talking about paradigms, worldviews, ontology, epistemology, axiology, and doing a very good job of it. Today is the second half of the discussion where she moved on to tell us what the implications of that were for her research design. So we hope you find this second half of the discussion as interesting as the first. Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 4, Participatory Research in Education. So let's imagine you were a different kind of person. Let's sort of, as we take stock, as we're about to move on to kind of what you're actually going to do. Let's imagine you were a super positivist person. You felt that maybe PCK is a thing, almost like a tangible thing, that you can go and you can shine a light on and you can uncover it by going in as a pure researcher and going, there it is, it looks like this, it's shaped like this and it's this colour. This is what PCK is, I'm telling you it's that. You might be a little bit further away from that, a little bit more down a sort of slightly more constructivist thing, and you would say, well, you know, I need to know what these student teachers and their mentors kind of think about it. I need to go in and I need to ask them stuff. I need to find out what they perceive, and I will sort of take all of that data and I will mash it all up and I will say, there we go, this is what these people think PCK is, and some of them think this and some of them are a bit more like this, which I think is probably quite similar to what I ended up doing actually on mine, quite a sort of let's go and let's talk to people and let's, you know, they'll have lots of input and then in the end I'll kind of go as this. But as we've just heard from your kind of, you know, talking about yourself and your values, and I say this with love, you're a person who would much rather take the more nuanced, the harder, the messier, the more difficult, the more sort of, you know, bramble infested and slightly difficult route to this stuff. And rightly so, I think, having kind of joined you on that journey as you interrogated all this stuff and ended up where you ended up. It's going to be a lot more messy than that, listeners. So let's find out what it is that you ended up wanting to do.
Right. Okay. So I stumbled across, when I was looking at paradigms, actually, participatory research methodology. Just to backtrack a tiny bit, I won't go on too much about this. So the two paradigms that I sort of leant towards, having done all that work on ontology, etc., were the interpretive paradigm, which I think best describes what you were talking about there, Tom, and how you approached yours. So that's about meaning making. It's constructivist. It tends to be qualitative, although it doesn't rule out quantitative, and interactionist. So like you knew you needed to interact with the people in that world to find out what was going on in that world.
I feel happy in that world.
Yeah, interpretive.
Like yeah, nice.
Interpretive.
Qualitative, not too crazy.
But then I read about the critical paradigm, okay? And there were bits, this is where, you know, that point I made earlier on about, you know, paradigms will take you so far, but you've got to think critically about them. So the critical paradigm is emancipatory and concerned with advocacy / participatory approaches, transformatory, qualitative and quantitative, concerned with analysis of power and ideology. So things like, you know, a feminist approach to, you know, critical feminist approach to researching, you know, you're coming at it with knowledge that there is a power imbalance at play, and your job, as part of your job as the researcher, is to sort of uncover that power construct and to sort of empower and emancipate people from the shackles of power. And I'm being really sort of reductive there, and I'm generalizing a little bit. So, you know, when I got into that territory, I was a bit like, oh, okay, I'm not really trying to free anybody from the shackles of. However, I didn't want to work with participants in a way that put me in a position of power and higher status as the researcher. So that was the problem I was having. I mean, participatory research, just to get into this a bit more now, we start to see like where the critical comes through, but where also the interpretive is important, is it's an instance of critical theory because it breaks with conventional ways of construing research. It concerns doing research with people and communities rather than doing research to or for people and communities. It is premised on the view that research can be conducted by everyday people rather than an elite group of researchers. And this can happen in a lot of different spheres. It tends to happen a lot in the medical sphere. It happens a lot in education. So you've got, you know, I remember when I was in school, we had researchers come in with these, I think they were either heart rate monitors or like pedometers, and they were trying to research, you know, how much kids were moving in the classroom.
I thought they were researching how much you were moving.
No, not me. There was another one where they were researching teacher talk, and it was very much like the researchers were coming in, they were doing a thing, they were going to go away, they were going to write up, and it felt very much like nothing to do with me. In a more sort of malign way, felt like it was being done to me, and oh my gosh, like what are they going to think about how much I talk in the classroom? And you know, I wasn't being sort of brought on board with the researchers that were coming in; they were doing it to me. And so, it's acknowledging, going back to epistemology, that knowledge, people who are experiencing the phenomena that you are investigating have valid knowledge and understanding of that thing. And this is why participatory research methods are found in the medical world and discipline of research too, because how can you find out about how a particular drug is working or the experiences of people with diabetes? Well, you can ask them to maybe think about how it's best to conduct that research because they're actually living with it. So they might be able to tell you a thing or two about what sort of questions you ought to be asking, like whether you're even going after the right thing in your research. So this leads us to another dimension of participatory research, in that the idea of it is, in its purest form, particularly when it's community-based participatory research, is that they tell you, the community tell you what you should be researching. You work with them to decide and facilitate and support like how that's going to happen. They gather the data with or for you. So there are sort of levels of participation in participatory research, and some people will sort of adhere to a paradigm which is quite rigid and strict in terms of, you know, it has to be about, if you're thinking about it, emancipating people and it being, you know, not about you and really sort of breaking down that power relationship between researcher and communities, then it, you know, from start to finish, the whole thing needs to be bottom up. However, there are other researchers out there and people who have sort of contributed to our understanding of this methodology that say that it's a principle-based methodology, and that rather than it being sort of like a strict, rigid way of doing something, if you adhere to the principles of participatory research, then you can be a lot more sort of flexible and therefore a lot more supportive of the people in the community that you are researching with. So what are those principles then? So some of the principles are democracy as a precondition for participatory research. So you sort of have to believe that everybody should have a say in how we investigate this phenomenon. Now, some of you out there might be thinking, well, you decided, Em, what you were going to investigate. You chose PCK. That's a bit of a complication, isn't it? I really worried about that at the start. But then I read a bit more and I found that there are education researchers that have worked in collaboration with schools who have had this same dilemma. One person in particular who is a science education researcher, and she said that although the research project stemmed out of an actual need to improve the local practice, she was a PhD student as well, this particular researcher found that her goals diverged more and more from those of her teacher colleagues as she was doing the research. So this is sort of pointing towards something that can happen in participatory research, that this sense of ownership and power and over different parts of the research process. So for example, if you're doing it in a sort of participatory reaction research way, there's a bit where your participants, the people who your co-researchers are maybe going to be doing something in the classroom, and you sort of lose ownership and control over it there as a researcher. You don't know how that's going to play out, but they then take on a lot of the risk and a lot of the ownership for that bit of the process. So democracy as a precondition is one of the principles. The need for a safe space is another one that comes through, and that's in air quotation marks.
We do get a bit twitchy with safe spaces.
Yeah, we do. So yeah, like issues.
Our university people.
Yeah. So like, you know, I suppose what that means to me is that if you want people to feel that their version of reality, their views about how to research something counts, then you're going to have to be open to the fact that like their epistemology might be different to yours. So you're going to have to get all of that out there from the start. And it needs to be a space where people can speak freely about the thing that you want to investigate, because their view might not be mine. And if they get a sense that, you know, there is a power dynamic at play, then they won't necessarily feel that they can say, well, I think this is what we should be researching here, and this is how we ought to be doing it, and haven't you thought about this? So that's why you need that safe space. You also need to identify who participates and how the community is defined. So like, you know, who is that community? Who is going to participate, you know, and at what stage is they going to be participating, and to what degree are they going to be involved? And then establish the degrees of participation. You know, are they actually going to be doing something? And therefore, are they going to be taking on workload as a result of that? And also, you've got this this challenge of differences in knowledge and experience. So like I've just talked about epistemology, ontology and axiology. I can't guarantee, and I shouldn't assume, that people participating in participatory research from the community with me are going to have that knowledge from the start. They might not even have that knowledge of PCK. So it's complicated by the fact that we, the researcher and the community, might be inhabiting very different worlds.
And this has been a really interesting learning experience for me, hearing you kind of go through this. And there's been a couple of things that have come out of this for me. One of them was the fact that we're sort of teetering along a bit of a line here. We're very, very happy in the interpretivist kind of area. You know, that's lovely and comfortable for us. We're both pretty uncomfortable with a kind of right down one end of the critical, the sort of very emancipatory standpoint activist, throw off the shackles stuff, you know, not because, as I said, I'm some sort of anti-feminist or massive racist or anything like that. It's just that complete sort of leaving behind of any form of neutrality starts to get a little bit uncomfortable. But there is a bit of that world, there is a kind of amount of that which feels like it's a really valuable addition to that interpretivist approach.
Yeah.
There is a level of emancipation, there is a level of involvement of the community, which feels absolutely right for a world in which we're supposed to be working in partnership with a teaching profession. And therefore, I've now got a much more nuanced view of that critical bit, which I initially just ran a mile from when I first read about it. Because again, like you were saying earlier with something else, I probably had a very simplistic view of it and I did not understand the full sort of length of that continuum. And also how those two things can sort of be fused together to create something that is slightly richer than just one on its own. And it does feel like something that we really need to understand more about because of the world in which we work, which is a world of partnership with schools.
Yes, I think so. I think it's potentially a harder road, and it's a scary road because, for example, in this assignment, I've got to write down what methods I'm going to use. And the honest answer is I don't know yet, because the community of participants that I'm working with, I need to negotiate that with them. I need to discuss that with them. We need to co-construct that together. And so I suppose it could be open to a lot of criticism because, you know, you can't neatly lay out your instruments on a table and go, you know, I'm going to do this exactly like this, and this is exactly how I'm going to make sure it's ethically sound. Because that's another thing, like, there is this concept of sort of relational ethics that I don't know enough about to talk about on this podcast yet, but I'm assuming that, like, you know, there is, it's constantly being negotiated, that the ethics of this research, I'm going to constantly need to be constructing and reconstructing as we go through the project, a bit like that lovely episode that we had with
Lisa Reed.
Go back and listen to that if you haven't listened to it already. So, you know, it's a bit scary because I can't put all my ducks in a row, but it feels more, I don't know, sort of axiologically right and reassuring, because it's not all coming from me. And it's the sort of relationship that I want to establish with the people who I think are going to need to participate in this study. So mentors, drama mentors, working in schools with student teachers, and the student teachers themselves, that they don't see me as the person who holds the knowledge and who is deciding on what happens when student teachers in drama learn.
Yeah, it feels like you're on a thin line, doesn't it? Not that I want to frighten anyone here, but you're on a bit of a thin line, because it feels like you're going to do a whole lot more good than those people who are clipping pedometers to kids and, you know, stop watching your teacher talk and stuff like that, because you are involving people, and that's great. But it does feel like if you don't do an awful lot of kind of self-awareness and self-examination, there is room for some quite sneaky soapboxing if you're not careful.
Yeah, there is. I think the thing that, as I've been reading, the thing that comes up quite a lot as a bit of a mitigating factor to that is reflexivity. So having moments all the time in the every part of the process where you're encouraging everybody that's participating to be reflexive. So, you know, that question about, you know, why am I thinking and behaving in this way? You know, why do I think it should be or shouldn't be researched in this way? So sort of keeping that worldview in check, or at least exposing that to the people that you're with all the time, so that you can, you know, try to make space for each other, accommodate one another, and also in the process of the research and for anybody, you know, reading it and thinking, you know, is this valid? Is this reliable? Well, as long as you've sort of said there were these problems that came up, then the person reading it can take that into consideration when they're reading your conclusions, that, you know, things came up along the way that were bumps in the road. And so reflexivity is really important. So, you know, that has consequences for the way that I, because there is a bit of facilitation to be done. When you're the researcher, you do need to sort of bring those people together and say, I want to do this. What do you think? So you've got to sort of try and bake those important parts of the process to sort of get the best out of this whole participatory research approach, that try to ensure that this is a robust and a reliable study.
And presumably there will be compromises along the way as well, because I suppose there's a sort of ideal, absolutely 100% pure version of participatory research that can probably in the real world never exist. Mm. If you want to ever complete your work, or, you know, not have them all get doctorates with you or something like that. You know, there's going to be impurities along the way, just because otherwise stuff's just not going to get done.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And again, I come back to this example of a PhD student who did this. And she said, as she took, or it says of her, as she took part in PhD courses at the university, she gradually developed a theoretical understanding of the research objective that was not fully available to her colleagues. You know, there are other instances in the literature where, whether you're a PhD student or not, ownership comes into it. So, like, when you're writing up the paper, I can't necessarily expect, I mean, it's my PhD at the end of the day, it's my ED. I can't therefore expect participants in my study to write it up. However, I can put checks and balances in place such that I check with them that it is a fair and truthful, according to their sense of truth, representation of what happened and what they thought to be the case. But, you know, it is, the waters are muddied by these issues of ownership and simple pragmatic things like timescales. But that, you know, that is something that is, you know, acknowledging the well-being and the workload of the participants as well. You know, we can't, it would be lovely to say, oh yeah, they're going to do it all. However, they are working with their own contextual demands and things that they care about and they're worried about and whatever. So you can't ethically, you know, in this quest to emancipate them and to give them ownership over everything, you can't then inadvertently create more risk for them and potentially do more harm. There's another really interesting, complicated factor about ethics in that the participants, they're also co-researchers, so you want to acknowledge them in the work. So in any sort of publications, you'd want to acknowledge them. However, they are often contributing to data as well from their own perspective. So you have an ethical duty to anonymize them and to protect their anonymity. So it's quite complicated.
It is quite complicated. I was just sitting here thinking, well, why don't we do this more often in education research? This sounds like absolutely the thing we should be doing more of. And then I sort of thinking, oh, and it sounds really hard.
Yeah. And I am very aware of that. And I think, gosh, anybody out there doing a PhD knows that it is incredibly difficult. And I think I'm starting to understand some of the reasons why. And I think it's because, in one sense, it is incredibly personal. It gets to some aspects of your personality and your identity that, you know, mean that you're constantly in a battle with yourself. So I'm in a bit of a moral dilemma here, in that, you know, have I really chosen the right approach? You know, I'm saying I want to do participatory research, but I actually know at the same time that there are certain bits of it that I'm not going to be able to do in its purest, most unfettered form. So, you know, am I doing the right thing there, or am I just sort of like, you know, who am I really doing that for? If I was being super cynical, you know, am I just trying to do something super different? But then I come back to my absolute reality, which is that we've been doing a lot more co-construction work with schools just lately, over the last couple of years, and I've become more and more convinced about the power of that and the consequences of that, not only for the student teachers on our programmes, but also for the teacher educators in the equation. I think that I've got a much better relationship and a much better understanding of the world that teacher educators in schools are inhabiting now, because we've co-constructed together, than I ever did before in the previous iterations of the programmes.
And you did a little pilot, didn't you, of this with your lovely participants / co-researchers.
I did.
/ anonymous, non-anonymous people.
And, I did.
And they came up with some stuff that surprised you, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, they did come up with some stuff. Reluctant to reveal anything just yet. Mm. But one big theme that I think is going to come out of that pilot is that, because, you know, the pilot was about basically asking them, do you think PCK is a thing that's worth investigating? What bits of it do you think we should investigate, and how should we do that?
There's a risk right there, isn't it? Because they could have come up with an answer that would have holed your ED below the waterline straight away. And be
yeah.
Like, nope, not interested.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, without revealing too much, there were a couple of moments where I was like, however, the overriding thing that has convinced me now that I'm going down the right road is that they came up with things that I absolutely wouldn't have been able to come up with on my own, because I'm not living in their worlds. I've read a really interesting article about education researchers collaborating with schools and how they're sort of inhabiting each other's castles. There are different rules, there are different codes, there are different laws, there are different words, discourse, like that you've got to, but the only way to really understand that is to get is to inhabit each other's castles. And I think that's what we were doing. And then as a result, it was like, oh my gosh, I've got a different take on PCK already now, and how we could and might investigate this that wouldn't have been the case if I hadn't gone down this road.
Yeah, and we don't want to go down a rabbit hole with this, but there is a whole interesting discussion to be had about the fact that we're kind of officially university bods now, academics, as they call it. I think we all like to think that we're still teachers. And in some ways, we can sort of read the invisible stuff that comes out when we talk to teachers. But on the other hand, we would be kidding ourselves if we said we're still 100%, you know, getting the real deal when we go into those other castles and we speak to teachers and you know, we interact with them. We'd be kidding themselves if they're really, really telling us 100% of absolutely everything, because we're not really part of the club anymore.
No. And I guess that's, again, I come back to this sort of emancipatory thing that, like, I think what I'm trying to do in some ways as well is to try to show them by saying, I want to investigate this with you, that I don't know any more about drama teaching than they do, or at least I've got a very different view of how to educate drama teachers because of the castle that I'm inhabiting and the worldview I'm adopting. So I can't, because I don't want to perpetuate a view that is purely from that perspective, and because we are working in this type of model of teacher education, I want to work with you and construct the knowledge together. There is no hierarchy here. And in fact, it's funny because our mentors, they're the ones that decide whether the student teachers get qualified teacher status or not. Not me.
Yeah, this is true.
So, you know, I really want to, I think, you know, the heart of this is I want to work on those relationships, because I believe my worldview is that we are codependent in the world of education, and that we need to work together to make sense of and to make the best circumstances for learning and learners that we can, which sounds a little bit, you know, get your joss sticks out. But
no, well, you know, I'm sure anyone in a positivist world has probably miles down the road by now. But, well, given that we have been talking so long that our big screen studio animated graphic has actually frozen, should probably wrap up by saying, where are you off to next on this difficult and dangerous journey?
Yeah, okay, so I've done the pilot now. I've got to submit my methodology chapter next week.
And get you out of here then, back in front of your laptop.
Yeah. And then in a few months' time, I need to present my analysis of the pilot project and what I learned from that before going on to do the big project, which is going to be, you know, the next steps of participatory research. Because I think you could probably characterise the pilot stage as the inform and consult stage of the different sort of points of entry in the process of participatory research. So, you know, informing the participants about what you know, we might investigate, consulting them on, you know, how we might go about doing that. So then the next bit is to think about how we're actually going to do that in practice, and then write it up, and then hopefully I get my doctorate.
Dr. O'Duha strides the stage. Excellent. Well, I would ask you for some good signposts for anyone who's grabbed by that, but I do believe that's going to be one of your short slot items.
So
we will, I think, move on to the infamous homework slots.
Yeah.
And it looks to me like you're something interesting is a handy signpost for anyone that hasn't run screaming away from their headphones at the thought of doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, I was just trying to find a book or a few different books that would sort of clearly explain to me what epistemology, ontology and axiology are. And you know, that's not to be unkind to
methodology geeks.
Yeah. But I found a chapter written by somebody called James Marr, and the chapter is called Making Sense of Research Methodology, and he certainly did for me. But it's in a book, an edited book called Doing Research in Education, Theory and Practice, by three different editors, some of whom's name I can't pronounce. So have a look at that. And then if you want to know more about participatory research methods, there's a nice article that I think is open access by Vaughan and Jacques, called Participatory Research Methods, Choice Point in the Research Process in the Journal of Participatory Research Methods. So, you know, if you want to find out a bit more about that, then you can have a read of that article.
And I think this is really interesting stuff. I think more people ought to be looking into this. I think it is one that we ought to understand more and potentially use more. And it's been very interesting talking to you about it, but also it is quite scary.
Yeah, it is quite scary. Yeah, I'll report back when I get on the other side.
So, something to try.
Yeah, this is just quite a fun one, actually.
In one of our special new definitions of the word fun. Go on, then.
Oh, someone out there is going to be like, do not do this. Again, in my quest to understand epistemology, ontology and axiology, I came across a blog. I can't remember what website it was on. I really should have written that down. But if you just do a bit of a Google search about, you know, simple explanation of, or how do I find out what my epistemology is? I found this blog where somebody said, look, if you're really tying yourself up in knots in this and you just want to take 2 minutes and have a bit of fun, there are some quizzes online. So you can try like an epistemology quiz and they ask you a number of questions. One of them is if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound? Yeah. But there are some other, like there were some other questions that were really interesting. It was like one about history, about, you know, can we ever really find out the truth of history, of something that went on in history? And it gives you, it's multiple choice. It gives you three possible choices. And then at the end of it, it says, ah, you're a subjectivist, or ah, you're an objectivist, you're a positivist. So, you know, it's a bit sort of, you know, those teenage girl mags that used to have back in the 90s.
About email. People used to email these around, didn't they? And you used to fill them in and email them to all your friends.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah,
that?
I do.
Old we are.
Showing our age
by
now.
Email.
But if you want it, you know, if you're getting, tying yourself up in knots and you want a bit of fun, then try one of those. But you could then, you know, a bit more deep and meaningful, consider how your ontology, epistemology and axiology influence your teaching practice. You know, influence your thoughts about assessment, about behaviour management, about how learning happens, about your subject. And, you know, I might sort of reveal some interesting things about, you know, the way you practice as a teacher.
It is genuinely interesting stuff. I've just got a great idea for a light episode in which we just pull in various well-known characters from the podcast and get them to do those quizzes.
Oh, yeah.
That would be so much fun.
I thought, oh my God, this is going to be the longest episode ever, but I nearly did this quiz
you
on you.
Do yeah. We'll do that in a future episode. We'll file that one away. Emma O'Duha, you have been amazing. What a great guest. Thank you for coming in and doing that. I think there's something for everyone in there.
Oh, hopefully. I hope you haven't run a mile. And sorry if you've had to listen to that in three instalments on three dog walks. Or
there's a very few very tired dogs out there, or some very, very clean washing up. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with some more lovely goodness. In the meantime, I hope you found that very interesting. Emma's off for a very short lie down in a darkened room prior to writing up the rest of her work. And we will be back with you soon. Take care.
Bye.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. Thanks to Emma for providing 2 episodes worth of goodness, and we're looking forward to hearing more about her doctoral studies soon. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamben, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.